Welcome to another in our series of podcasts. I'm Jimmy Fitz, a.k.a. Crypto Fitz. Really excited about my special guest today, Ron Geffner, former Securities and Exchange Commission enforcement lawyer. Ron S. Geffner is a security industries expert and founding member of the Satis and Goldberg LLP's Executive Committee, overseeing the Financial Services Group. His broad background includes knowledge of federal and state securities laws and the rules, regulations, and customary practices of the SEC, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and various other regulatory bodies. He also provides legal services to hundreds of hedge funds, private equity funds, and venture capital funds organized in the United States and offshore. Ron began his legal career with the SEC, where he investigated and prosecuted violations of the federal securities laws, with an emphasis on enforcement in connection with violations of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 and the Investment Company Act of 1940. He also assisted federal and state criminal agencies, such as the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Attorney General's Office, in their investigations of possible criminal violations of federal and state securities laws. We welcome to Crypto Fitz, Ron Geffner. Ron, so happy to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, your background is just incredible. You began your legal career with the SEC, which I found fascinating. And I guess my first question to you is, first of all, why don't you tell us what the top job and goal of the SEC is, for those who don't know, because I think many people, Ron, had never even given any thought to the Securities and Exchange Commission, most Main Street people, the SEC, and of course the last few years with the lawsuits in the crypto world and everything that's been going on, now people have more of an understanding of what the SEC is and what they do. But I'd like to hear from you, what is the top job and goal of the Securities and Exchange Commission?
The Securities Exchange Commission is in place to enforce the federal securities laws. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal securities laws are designed to create an equal playing field for all investors.
Mm-hmm. What were some of your positive and negative memories of being at the SEC?
Well, there are almost all positive. It was just a great place to work and start my legal career. It gave me a sense of really the marketplace and some of the really bad things that were going on in the marketplace, mm-hmm. and some of the really good things that were going on in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
If you look back to the federal securities laws, they came into place starting in 1933. There starts with the Securities Act of 1933. And this sort of ties into my experience at the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, if you look back to the stock market crash
right. Back
then in the late 20s, it was snake oil salesmen in many situations,
mm-hmm.
and people manipulating the marketplace.
Sure.
Not to say that people don't try,
right.
but if you now fast forward, it's almost 100 years, not really, but it's close.
Mm-hmm.
The laws are designed in place so that every person listening to this podcast has the same equal opportunity as anybody else to access to information so that it becomes fair and balanced,
mm-hmm.
making it harder for certain people to get what people on Wall Street like to refer to as an edge.
Mm-hmm.
That said, people have to now be creative, not creative in an illegal way. People aggregating data that's public and trying to be able to form opinions on things that might affect businesses whose securities trade on the exchange. So my experience at the SEC, and I was focused on prosecuting asset managers, investment advisors, wealth managers, hedge fund managers, things of that nature,
mm-hmm.
was get the facts, understand the law, apply to the law to the facts. It was protecting society. I don't know how anybody who is not a public servant doesn't feel a sense of success or some positivity out of that relationship of looking out for your fellow person.
Exactly. Sure. I'm sure you sent shivers up some spines during those days, Ron, when you would call and say, yes, it's Ron Geffner, SEC enforcement lawyer. Can I speak to Joe Blow, please?
Now, I'd like to take the position. I think I'd like to hope I still send shivers up people's spines. But yeah, more so when I was at the SEC.
I guess so. That's so funny.
I'm not old enough to be taken out of pastor and retired.
Oh, well, that's good. You know, now you have a lot of chapters still to go, Ron. And with this background that you have now, isn't it interesting how times change so quickly now these days, especially with the tech world that we live in and the instant gratification world that we live in? And one bit of news travels around the world instantaneously, and as we say, that negative and false fake news gets out there. And once it gets out there, even if it's corrected, it's hard to bring it back. And people just want to latch on to the first thing they hear. So let's talk a little bit about what everyone has been hearing, even if they're not in the crypto space. Let's talk about this FTX situation for a second, if we could. Sam Bankman-Fried getting 25 years. We know it. It was intertwined with Alameda Research, et cetera, et cetera. What's your 30,000-foot view on that whole chapter, that whole drama, and how it's wrapped up at this point in time?
Obviously, Sam Bankman-Fried's behavior was deplorable, and many people were harmed. Mm-hmm. But with regard to the 25-year criminal sentencing, I would say, from my perspective, it seems fair and warranted. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you the basis for it. His lawyers wanted, I believe, 6.5 years. Mm-hmm. Prosecutors wanted 40 to 50 years.
Right.
And we look at things on a relative basis. Madoff got over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Skilling, I think, received a 24-year sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And then conversely, Elizabeth Holmes received an 11-year sentence. Just to put it out there so that we understand what the marketplace looks like on judgments.
Sure.
So he didn't get off light,
mm-hmm.
yet he's not in jail for the duration of his natural life. But it arguably serves as a deterrent. Now, if you want to get into the concept of deterrent, I would tell you, from my experience, people I have met and spoken to, I don't believe that they went out into the marketplace looking to defraud investors on average.
Mm-hmm.
I think it becomes a slippery slope.
Sure.
It's more ego or mm-hmm. fear of judgment of others, and that they start to bend the truth to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And that slippery slope, you know, as Shakespeare would say, you know, a web of lies, right? Mm-hmm. Once we first practice to deceive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happens. So when we talk about these criminal sanctions as a deterrent, I've never met somebody who said, well, I'm debating on doing this, but for this deterrent.
Right.
The people that would think that way are probably the people that would comply with the law to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it was 50 years, 25 years, or 10 years,
right.
The good people don't even want 1 year. They don't even want 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe the deterrent factor really is accomplished. I think it's more of a function of, do people feel satisfied that he's being punished for his wrongs? It's more an eye for an eye is how I
sure.
think it really affects society.
Sure. All right, let's take a little different angle on this. Yes, I think everyone pretty much is in agreement. Consensus is that he needed to pay a penalty, obviously. Seems to be fair, as I understand it, a federal sentencing, you have to serve 85%. He will be guaranteed to have to serve 85% of that 25 years. Am I correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So now let's take it from the investors in FTX's perspective. And can we play this little back and forth point counterpoint? Can you take the point of FTX's attorney saying that they wanted to make whole the people who got their money or their crypto caught on that implosion back in November of 2022? Back then, the average price for Bitcoin for the month of November was about $17,400. All right? We know where it is today. So now they say they want to make everyone whole on the money and the holdings that they had with FTX at that time. Now, the counterpoint to that is that I had, hypothetically speaking, on FTX, one Bitcoin. One Bitcoin was worth 17.4 then. As we record this podcast, it's in the low 70s, okay? About 72,000 for one Bitcoin. Do I want that fiat USD and settle with FTX for 100 cents on the dollar of what I had then? Or because my crypto has been basically frozen, I haven't been able to cash it in, I haven't been able to swap it for anything else, I want my one Bitcoin. Can you chew on that debate a little bit?
Well, so you want replacement of the asset specifically in the form that was taken from you.
That's what I was, that's what I bought.
As opposed to the replacement value
right.
from a dollar perspective.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I mean, and are you taking the, and you'd like me to take the position as if I were representing FTX in the sense that, well, look, we're giving you the valuation of the asset that you had at the time you invested it or gave it to us or trusted us with your asset.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the argument is, what is it? It's a fungible asset that has fiat value, and that's what we're giving you, and those, your damages were met.
Mm-hmm.
It's really that simple of a claim.
What would you say on behalf of my of me or a customer of FTX in that situation?
Well, I would say two things. One, it's not the value of the date I gave it to you. It's the value if I still own that asset as of today.
Mm-hmm.
As a primary. And then the secondary position I would take would have been your fraud and the damages determined. If the market turned against you at that time and Bitcoin went to a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And my damages were far worse. Yeah, you know, it's to me, a fraud is a fraud is a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
You stole from me.
Right.
You lied to me.
Mm-hmm. What side of the coin,
the damages may determine the judgment.
Right.
But it's also in my mind, how many times have you lied to me? And how many times was that repeated?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How many people did you lie to?
Right.
Not just me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if we leave you in the marketplace, how many more people will you lie to in the future?
What's your gut as to who's going to come out on top when this gets settled? Are they going to pay 100 cents on the dollar, or are they going to give them their Bitcoin?
So that I cannot comment on due to matters our firm is engaged in representation tied to FTX.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Okay, it's an interesting question.
I'll gladly meet you for a cup of coffee and tell you my thoughts then.
Okay, well, I look forward to that. let's talk about the proposal to expand the SEC commissioners to 6 and adding a vice chair, as I understand it, and some proposed restructuring of the Securities and Exchange Commission these days.
Yeah, so based on your question, what do you see as a basis for why that might be occurring?
Because I believe there's a proposal or a bill on Capitol Hill that's been introduced to that effect.
No, I understand that. But what's driving it? Is it the fact that the SEC is broken and not failing, or is it the fact that people hate the chairman?
Probably is a combination of the above. If you go out in the marketplace and do a survey, Hester Peirce, who is one of the commissioners, has been pretty outspoken about being a bit frustrated regarding the SEC's, as she called it, a slow roll on defining regulation of crypto. And I know that the chair of the SEC, Gary Gensler, says we already have rules in place.
And therein lies a conundrum. And this has been going on since, I don't know now, it's 15 years?
Mm-hmm, right.
Is this a new technology that requires new rules?
Mm-hmm.
Or do the rules apply? And that goes back to the SEC versus Howey test.
Right.
Which leads us into the conversation on really the seminal case would be, I think, SEC versus Ripple.
Mm-hmm.
which I found fascinating because it was a little bit of don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, Solomon-like conclusion that came out.
Right.
So I historically been of the mindset on average, and this I think would define that, is I think the old rules do apply. I know there are some exceptions to it, and whether cryptocurrencies are securities.
Mm-hmm.
And other people liken it to the fact that I'm trading baseball cards or coins or some other asset that's not a security where there's no investment contract.
Mm-hmm.
And for those listeners, to make life easy so they don't have to go online and research out SEC versus Howey, it's a four-prong test. And this case came out in 1946.
Wow.
To put it in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The four prongs are if a reflection of an investment of money, second prong in a common enterprise, three with an expectation of profit, and four from the investment of others.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept of an investment contract and reflecting either hoping to make money on the a profit from the effort of others or an investment of money. Those are some of the prongs that Ripple used effectively in defending the case against their XRP token against the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And for those listeners, we'll break that down also if you're okay with this.
Sure.
There were four main categories of sales of XRP. The first was sales of XRP directly to institutional investors.
Right.
Second is algorithmic sales of XRP on trading platforms.
Mm-hmm.
The third was distributions of XRP to Ripple employees and third parties.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sales, and then the fourth were sales by the C-suite,
right,
Garlinghouse and Larson on various trading platforms.
Right.
And the SEC concluded that in three of those cases, XRP was not a security, and only in one of those four was it a security.
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
So, with regard to the one that they felt was a security, the judge, was a sale to institutional investors. And there were written contracts between Ripple and its wholly owned subsidiaries to institutional investors.
Right.
And that was deemed to be one of the prongs that wasn't satisfied in some of the other transactions. The ones that were done on an exchange, they were blind trades,
mm-hmm,
meaning Ripple did not know who was buying XRP.
Right.
And the purchasers did not know who was selling it. And the third prong, meaning an expectation of profits, and fourth prong, which were based on the effort of others, because they're programmatic sales. And one other variable that I thought was very fascinating was the court found that there was not any evidence that Ripple distributed promotional materials, marketing reports, or public statements to the purchasers on the digital exchanges, that it wasn't clear that the purchasers were doing it hoping to profit off of the efforts of others, which really muddies the water. So I understand when, and going back now to the question of the laws and have the laws matched up, I think it's going to be more important to determine applying the law and an interpretation of the existing law.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe that we need new regulation per se, but more interpretive guidance on the legislation as it applies to cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that how do you see this playing out going forward, and how do you see the rectification of this? I mean, as soon as this, they really got into the legal Ripple and SEC tangle there, they Coinbase stopped sales of XRP, and you couldn't buy XRP. Now you can buy XRP on Coinbase. What would you say change with them now, even though the end of that suit really hasn't been resolved?
Well, so in those situations, the fact that Ripple, as of now, seems to have won the battle with regard to XRP being sold on a platform or exchange,
right,
I would believe that Coinbase feels it's safer for them to allow it to trade on their platform. It's that simple. Now, you're right. What happened was in December of 2020, when the lawsuit was filed by the SEC, Coinbase stopped trading, and arguably XRP really suffered because it missed the height of a crypto bull market back then.
Right.
I think Bitcoin went up to over 60,000, and I think it was like 62,000 at the high in 2021.
Yep.
If I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
It's so really, law is just a variable. It's hard to say law is an absolute, like it's a black and white thing.
Right, right.
And I'd say one of the takeaways for somebody who doesn't really want to get into the weeds,
right,
or is confused by the weeds, so to speak,
mm-hmm,
is that this really was a damaging blow to the SEC's stated position that cryptocurrencies are always securities.
Mm-hmm.
That to me would be the takeaway if I were trying to assess the effect that this is going to have on the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. What about the fact that Gary Gensler, the chair of the SEC, before the House Finance Subcommittee, on more than one occasion being questioned, would not directly answer the question about, is Bitcoin a security or is Ethereum a security? When he was talking about Bitcoin, he referred to former commissioners and chairs who had already stated the SEC's stance on that. So what is the SEC's stance on that? Is Bitcoin a commodity or a security for those casual listeners?
It's definitely not a security.
It's not
the SEC's position, I think, to determine whether something is deemed to be a commodity. That would be the CFTC.
Right.
And from my time, while I was at the Division of Enforcement with the SEC in New York,
right,
there's some degree, I don't want to say it's a turf war, but it wasn't just the SEC, it's every agency. To look at it, even with our criminal perspective, which SEC is not criminal,
right,
between the Department of Justice, the FBI,
sure,
state and local authorities, people want to usually take control over actions and claim it as their own.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing occurs between the CFTC and the SEC at times as well. So I don't want to paint the SEC in a bad with a bad brush, because that's not the case.
Sure. So where we sit today, have they clarified between the two of them who oversees Bitcoin?
Yeah, hold on. I'm trying to remember. I believe
Rostin Benham, the head of the CFTC, has been pretty vocal about saying what his perspective is.
And what was his perspective?
That CFTC should be the overseer.
Yeah, and the CFTC, look, the CFTC and the SEC are still working through all these things.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be, it's a tough job, especially, I mean, I can't imagine how the SEC can even go to work every day and go, okay, we got 25,000 plus cryptos and counting every day that we're trying to vet and trying to do public good and protect people from the nefarious actors. It's not an easy job, is it, Ron?
No, it's not. But going back to it, so Bitcoin is considered a commodity under the Commodity Exchange Act.
Mm-hmm. And that gives it a lot of utility, quote unquote, different than they use utility in the crypto world, as we know. But also, obviously, it opened up a lot of people's eyes when these spot Bitcoin ETFs got approved, it actually took that little paranoia, I guess, because it was approved. There was the big lead up to January 10, as we know. Will it be approved? Will they approve these? Will they reject them all? Will they kick them all back to the applicants? Will one, two, or three get approved? Inquiring minds wanted to know back then. And we see the surge right out of the gate with, so much money and so much inflow into this record-breaking product on Wall Street, setting all records for an ETF launch of any type. And I think it's been a good thing for the education of the mom-and-pop public who might have 401ks or might hold mutual funds or ETFs, and they don't really know what they are or how they're put together, you know?
Well, that would be the issue with regard to the investing public as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I remember it was probably two years ago, and I was somewhere public, and I was listening to two people talk about Dogecoin. And on one hand, I completely understand a reaction. On one hand, it's easy to laugh.
Right.
But on the other hand, when I think about my background, and I was listening to them, and I couldn't really help myself, I interrupted. I'm like, so what motivated you to buy it? And it was really more the hype.
Uh-huh.
The hype of hearing other people talk about it.
Right.
Yep. And
the FOMO. The
to make money and get on something early.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think back even to 2008. I went to an event in Miami on the crypto side, and I felt like I was at a Comic-Con event. And I sat there, I probably said less than three sentences in a few hours, which was a record for me. And everybody seemed to have a handle name. But if you look to where it was, to where it is, it's materially matured in those 16 years.
Boy, hasn't it?
And you're right, with the approval of the ETFs, as I was commenting about this in the marketplace, it seemed to me, which I didn't act on, that ETFs being approved by on behalf of large institutions that were the sponsors,
right,
that invariably the marketing machine was going to bring money into the ETFs, mm-hmm, which were going to go into Bitcoin. Then ideologically, I thought it was fairly sound to think Bitcoin would have gone up in value,
mm-hmm,
which it did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then the question is, the consumer, does the consumer really understand what they're investing in?
Mm-hmm.
And your opinion is as equally valid as my opinion, but my opinion is such that the average person doesn't really fully understand the implications of what it is they're investing in.
Right.
They don't understand the effect regulation may or may not have on it.
Right.
And the reason why it's important to define regulation, there's several reasons why. One, having the framework so people understand where the line is and what would lead to a violation of the law and what would not, so they know how to operate,
sure,
under business guidelines,
mm-hmm,
enables an industry to stabilize and potentially flourish.
Mm-hmm.
But conversely, what I also, and others I'm sure have seen and you've seen, is between then and now, there's a lot of misinformation, and there's a lot of people who are buying things and that we're taking advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And therein lies the balance. And it's going through the maturation process, and I feel it's safe for me to conclude that the regulatory framework will be defined, I'd like to think, in the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go say any time shorter if you ask me for a prediction.
Sure. There's a lot to dig through. My gosh, I can't imagine. I mean, 3 years would be a major accomplishment, really, when you stop and think about it.
Yeah, but it's been some time. And the challenge with Gensler, and I don't know him personally, are what appears to be the lack of consistency in his public statements from when he was teaching,
mm-hmm,
to where he is today.
When he was teaching at doing the MIT courses that anyone can view still on YouTube.
Correct, in, mm-hmm, which he indicated that cryptocurrency was not a security.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's at the helm of the SEC saying it is a security.
That's a big, broad statement, isn't it, Ron?
It's very hard to understand the position,
mm-hmm,
other than his role evolved. And so then the question is, arguably, as an academic, one would argue he might have had no dog in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And you got his true belief system.
Right, right.
Whereas at the SEC, one would argue he's there to promote the viability of the SEC. Mm-hmm. But the SEC has so much on its plate, and the reality and fairness to the SEC is when there's blood on the floor, no matter what, the SEC is blamed.
Mm, right, right. Naturally.
And what people don't appreciate, especially those that are dealing with the SEC, and I'm not suggesting that the regulator gets it right all the time, because they don't. And I'm not suggesting that at times there may not be bad apples in any organization.
Right.
But what people don't know, and this has been my experience from when I was at the SEC deposing people, when you're wearing that hat, people don't want to speak to you. Mm-hmm. Or people are not going to always be open and honest.
Right.
And so you have to dig. And conversely, anybody who gets in a scrap of the regulator, it's a loss right there. A win is a loss anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because it causes people that might be on the sidelines to question your intentions, right, your the quality of your business.
Sure.
Plus, there's a hard dollar cost to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you said, XRP then was frozen for the most part,
yep,
in December of 2020.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know the utility of XRP and what's been going on with them, but that's another conversation. I mentioned Hester Peirce, one of the SEC commissioners, and I saw a piece on her last year toward the fall, that she was voicing her frustration in an interview talking about during the 90s, during the tech explosion, the internet explosion, when we were all learning how to use our computers and email. You've got mail, AOL, dial up. Boy, that seems so, it was a while ago, but boy, have we come a long way since then, Ron. It's unbelievable. She said back then that because of this burgeoning technology, that the SEC did update and adjust some of their, I don't know if formal rules or the way they operated, or they were doing some tweaks, let's put it that way, make it simple, during the 90s for this burgeoning new technology that was, turning Wall Street upside down, and we saw all that was happening during those 90s leading up to the dot-com bust and all that stuff. But I just going back to what you had said about, 1930s, 1940 with the Investment Advisors Act, et cetera. Now you got this digital economy, digital assets. You have this talk of what's a security, what's a commodity. And for the average John and Jane Doe, they're scratching their head. They're losing hair. Every day they're scratching their head hearing about that stuff and not really necessarily knowing about it. So do you agree that the SEC might want to think about updating their rules and regs because of this industry?
Well, the SEC is routinely updating rules and regulations with regard to all the federal securities laws.
Mm-hmm.
There are either no action letters that come out, there are amendments to the laws. So they are routinely being updated. Pretty much everybody in law seems to be routinely updated. And from what my experience has been, and I've been practicing law since the early 90s, it's, I would say, the last 15 years, I feel like there have been more changes in laws than I recall in the earlier part of my career.
Hmm.
Laws continuously are getting more and more complex.
Is that good or a good thing or a bad thing?
Both. There's good and bad in it, like
sure,
everything else.
Of course.
So the good in it is we can generally, the more complex the law becomes and the more history we have in the law, the more we can predict the fact pattern and its viability under the law.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is the barrier to entry becomes higher because, I'll give you an example. People that are with regard to crypto, especially when it first started becoming more and more of a household name,
right,
there were people early days that started to manage other people's money in the crypto space.
Mm-hmm.
But they had no understanding or knowledge of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940.
Right.
That body of law governs a person in the United States on behalf of managing another person's money in the United States on investing in securities and licensing requirements, anti-fraud provisions, and a range of other rules and regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So people inadvertently were engaging in a business without complying with the law. It's like somebody starting a restaurant out of their garage,
right,
and not checking with their local authorities on how one goes to deal with it,
mm-hmm,
and to comply with all the rules
governing
how you prepare and serve food.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
The health department.
Right.
But that happens with every body of law, even including with zoning and construction.
Mm-hmm.
The more we learn, the more we try to prevent harm.
Right.
It's a paternalistic viewpoint that we take as a society.
Right.
And then also the cost of enforcement goes up from a regulator perspective,
sure,
too. Because what's the use of having laws that are not enforced? And I would go to, I'm sitting right now in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
When's the last time you were in New York City?
Just before COVID.
Okay. So if you went and visited New York City today.
That's my town, by the way.
Okay. Well, your town misses you. You should be coming back sooner.
I've lived 9 lives in New York.
So pre-COVID with regard to like cannabis, mm-hmm, like right now there's a handful of licensed dispensaries. You would not know that walking through the streets of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Every other block there seems to be a dispensary, but I would say the super majority of them, if not the plurality of them, are illegal.
Wow.
Consumers don't know that, so I don't know if they're buying contraband in their stores or not.
Wow.
So we have regulations on the books,
mm-hmm,
but where the governor is in New York enforcing it, or the mayor, or everybody else, who knows until there's a problem, mm-hmm, a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So having laws on the books that are not enforced are even more damaging than not having laws.
Yes.
Because there are people out there that sit there and think, I'm protected.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the consumer unaware, you know, ignorant and reliant on something that doesn't exist. So that's the other challenge of the SEC and the CFTC and all of the regulators.
That's it. That's interesting. And it's also, like you say, it's a two-edged sword, Ron. This is also because I think there's so much more conversation about this these days. And that's good. At the end of the day, educated consumers knowing the good and the bad and the ugly of anything is a good thing. So, unfortunately, you have to go through growing pains to get there sometimes. And it's like, look how much people have learned about the power of attorney generals and district attorneys across the country. Did they ever give 2 seconds thought about that before? When they go to vote, did they ever really realize the importance of their local elected officials, or do they just show up and vote for the presidential election? I think people have gotten such an education in the last 10, 15 years just with government and the process. So that's a good thing.
It is. But one of the other variables that is also different from when over the last 10 years alone,
mm-hmm,
is information. Pre-internet.
Right.
Information existed, but it traveled more slowly.
Yes.
And as you just said earlier, something said today here in New York could be heard within minutes, mm-hmm, in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
So the problem we're having as a consumer society as well is that there's so much data in the marketplace.
Right.
It's hard to know what data is reliable.
And also, everybody's a commentator and everyone's a journalist as well.
It is. And so I was at an event that one of my friends had hosted. And a question that he had asked the group, which I found really fascinating, was how many sources of information do you go to valid information these days? So you're just listening to mainstream media,
uh-huh,
listening to the main network?
Right.
Or are you going and checking the main network? Are you going to alternative sources of data?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard to know who has it accurate.
No doubt.
And whose information is coming to you that's biased.
Mm-hmm. You're not kidding.
And my impression, which I feel comfortable saying, is that the vast majority of Americans just really go to mainstream media. And I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not getting the nuanced perspectives because there's just so much information out there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't digest everything, mm-hmm, all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to pick and choose what it is you really care about.
Well, also is mob mentality as well, because people become part of a club. They watch this cable TV news network or that one, and they just soak in all the information, good, bad, and ugly, that they get, and they use it as gospel instead of digesting it, critical thinking it, and checking out alternative sources, like you're saying.
Yeah, I completely agree. And so one of the things I've sort of stated publicly pretty consistently is it's okay to... How you live your life is how you live your life. It's not my place to comment.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're writing checks to things that you don't understand,
right,
you're safer not doing that. And if you have the ability and the desire and drive, go and hire somebody that will
mm-hmm.
guide you,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a financial planner or an investment advisor or a wealth manager.
Right.
It's not a one-size-fits-all.
No doubt. Just like your health, there's not a one-size-fits-all.
No, but comparing that, if you feel a pain in your chest, do you go online and try to figure it out, or do you call a doctor?
Well, if you're
do you feel safe while your heart is palpitating,
uh-huh.
to say, well, I read this blog,
right.
and I understand how to interpret what I'm feeling,
right.
and I understand how to apply it, and I'm not going to be, and I have no regard for my genetic history. So why would you treat that differently than your financial health? Because
I know
financial health definitely is not as important as your physical health, but it is still more important than what you're going to have for dinner tonight.
No doubt.
You're not looking up a restaurant review on the
mm-hmm.
internet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the problem. And then we live in a society of finger pointers.
Yeah.
Where everybody's the victim.
Mm-hmm. Boy, you nailed that, Ron. No doubt about it. I've got two other topics I want to cover, but this, time goes so fast, I'm just thoroughly enjoying wrapping it down with you. Let's talk about Ethereum. Now, BlackRock, Fidelity have already filed for spot Ethereum ETFs. Without getting too deep in the woods for the newbies, Ethereum, when it was launched as a proof of work project, and then switched over to proof of stake, which in many minds converted it into a security. What's your viewpoint on Ethereum, and do you think that will be next up? They've already applied for it, BlackRock and Fidelity. Do you think that will be the next quote unquote crypto ETF?
Yeah, they're based on everything I've read. People believe that there's a greater than a 50% chance of approval by the SEC
mm-hmm.
On launching an ETF in connection with Ethereum,
right?
For spot Ethereum.
Mm-hmm. And
Ethereum is similar to Bitcoin, and the people I speak to actually seem to prefer Ethereum over Bitcoin. Well, mm-hmm. I shouldn't say the people. Some of the people prefer Ethereum. Some mm-hmm. prefer Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it seems to me inevitable that it will be approved. The question is when.
And you don't think that they're going to, because they have an Ethereum Foundation and they have a Vitalik, who's a very big name front for Ethereum. The argument from the Bitcoin community is that Bitcoin is not controlled by anyone. It has a cap supply of 21 million. It's cross-border, instantaneous, it's decentralized, et cetera, and they say Ethereum is like run by people, and that it's not decentralized, and thus can have nefarious actors in the middle of it.
Yeah, but then how does that any different than a security,
right?
And other assets,
right? Mm-hmm.
But the art world, something that there's finite
oh, yeah.
product.
Sure.
Well, finite product until it seems to go into a state, and then the state issues more product.
Right.
I'll leave that one alone. But yes, it's distinguishable from Bitcoin, but you're not. I don't see the government only allowing one asset to be put into an ETF from a similar field of assets.
Do you see XRP having an option to do that?
I think XRP needs to still work out some of their issues.
Mm-hmm.
Sideline with their sales to institutional investors. But, and in fairness, I haven't studied the totality of what I'm about to say, and it would require hundreds and hundreds of hours of analysis.
Sure.
It's given the case that with the SEC, the fact that it was deemed not to be security when XRP was traded on a platform.
Mm-hmm.
That would indicate that the SEC has a very weakened position here. The one that keeps me scratching my head is, in connection with the judge's ruling, is right. that Bitcoin XRP that was issued to employees,
right?
And they said there was no exchange of money. That's the part that I sit there and I think of people that I know worked the jobs in 2008 that got IOUs mm-hmm. in lieu of their wages and who left.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean to me they didn't interpret the IOUs or promissory note from the company that they worked for as having any value.
Huh.
Yet XRP, I didn't read anything to indicate that employees that were getting XRP in as form of compensation.
Right.
were leaving because they didn't value it. So to me, I view it as fungible to money.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It's a slight nuance, but as I kept reading it, and I didn't go through the transcript and all the other things
sure.
because it's not my primary job at the moment.
Sure.
It's and by the way, that is a ruling in a jurisdiction where there are other jurisdictions in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So there could very well be, and I'm not a litigator, but if you speak to litigators, they will talk about the fact that, yeah, this court decided it in this district, but there's other districts and the judges may have inconsistent outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, in part, you want law and statutes and not law determined by the outcome of litigation.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Well, I always found it interesting as a civilian, a non-lawyer, that... that the SEC approved Coinbase as a publicly traded company on the NASDAQ, and they got sued by the SEC because they part of that suit, without knowing all the details, but some of the highlights of that suit was that the SEC was alleging that XRP was they were selling unregistered securities on their exchange. And that went back to 2019. So my question is, if the SEC knew that Coinbase was offering up non-approved securities back then, how did they get through the vetting process and get approved as a public company 2 years later?
Yeah, but those are two different things. I understand. I think you're conflating two concepts here. It's whether Coinbase had a sufficient number. Did Coinbase meet the needs and requirements to register on an exchange?
Mm-hmm.
Is not necessarily tied to the products that they have and the viability of their business.
Okay. Gotcha.
So I view it as whether Coinbase can list as a function of the reporting requirements. Do you have the requisite number of shareholders? Do you have mm-hmm. the controls in place as a corporate entity mm-hmm. and not the product? Because I think of other public companies that issue some other product that society finds is unhealthy for, like tobacco companies.
Mm-hmm. Good example.
Yeah. Or drug makers.
Uh-huh.
They may come up with a drug that has a higher addiction rate than is disclosed.
Right.
Or public companies that might manipulate other assets that they control.
Mm-hmm.
Price fixing.
Right.
Violations of Foreign Corruption Practices Act.
Mm-hmm.
So the public listing of a company is not directly related to the products that they are selling or doing.
Okay, good. Thank you for that answer.
Well, that's what a law degree gets you. It was well worth the money.
No doubt. What a track record you have, Ron. It's just amazing, your journey and your knowledge. Last topic, central bank digital currencies, CBDCs. What is the SEC involvement in that process?
To be honest with you, that is a subject that I read about a while ago,
mm-hmm.
and then I spoke to somebody I knew personally at the Fed, and I didn't get the impression that it was getting a green light right away, but the person was a low-level
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to the SEC, I cannot imagine that the SEC would stand in the way of the government issuing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the curiosity I have is, when I look at crypto on a macro level,
right,
and I view it as, it's almost like a foreign currency or a currency.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar, like, does it replace gold? Those are the articles that I've been reading lately.
Right.
Does Bitcoin replace gold?
Mm-hmm.
And how do governments look at gold versus the value of their own currency?
All right. That's good. That's so interesting.
So when, if the United States government were to issue that token,
right,
its effect on the value of cryptocurrency as a whole. And it makes me think, my son just recently got engaged.
Okay.
And I haven't gone diamond shopping in 1,000 years. But the fact now that factory-made diamonds are virtually identical to the diamonds that are dug in mines, unless you're put under a super microscope,
right?
And it led to the devaluation of diamonds, makes me think of, well, what if the U.S. government issues a cryptocurrency?
Mm-hmm.
What effect does that have on the value of
mm-hmm.
all these other cryptocurrencies?
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, do you believe in government
mm-hmm.
and the backing of the currency that would be issued by the United States government? Or the same way cryptocurrency started, with decentralization.
Right.
And I think that goes really more to almost a political belief on the stability of countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, history shows that every government fiat currency, they inflate it out of existence. You go back through every civilization, through the evolution of when we use salt as a commodity or seashells as a commodity, and just the whole evolution. We saw what happened with the gold situation. People forget that gold was confiscated about around the same time period that you were mentioning about all these various acts being enacted, the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, et cetera. This was all when gold was still legal tender, but the government went and confiscated it.
But then also go back to, like, the tulip bulb craze in Holland. I believe it was the 1600s.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, the value of tulip bulbs were astronomical
mm-hmm.
until they weren't.
Right. Right.
So is that going to be the U.S. dollars? Is that going to be crypto? Or is that going to be something else?
Mm-hmm.
One never, ever knows. That's why I would go back to, you want to hire your professionals that know more about it, that have the edge, because they're sure. able to look at history, not that history or past performance is indicative of future returns, as they say.
Sure. Yeah. And Crypto Fits is not financial advice. It's entertainment and information, as we always encourage our listeners to do their own research. Ron, the practical applications of CBDCs is what I think about. I mean, people have their retirement funds. They hold annuities, life insurance policies, securities. How does that play out in an implementation of a rollout of a CBDC? And before you answer that, just my little opinion is that they are still trying to figure out what crypto is. I mean, I've listened to a lot of these hearings. I watch them conduct the House Financial Services Committee. I see the questions asked. I see the action. I see some of the misinformation put out by certain politicians about the space, et cetera, et cetera. So when I stand back from it, how are they going to implement something they really don't even understand what it is or how it even works? And then how does it get practical application across the whole financial system?
Great question. I really not sure of the answer to how that occurs. I have to imagine that would potentially go through banks
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as distributors of the U.S. dollar, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also really curious about the impact it has, like I said, on other cryptocurrencies,
mm-hmm.
on the impact of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I am concerned about the security of it.
Right. Exactly. And not to mention all.
I'll give you an example. Like, I open my laptop up, I'm constantly reading about how my passwords are being floated on the dark web and I should go and change them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's overwhelming given the number of websites I've purchased items from and other
sure.
Products I've consumed.
Right.
And between that and my day job, mm-hmm. if it's a couple of sites, yeah, I'm going to go and change those, the ones that really matter to me.
Right.
But otherwise, it's I don't have the fortitude and the capacity to constantly be running that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I sit there and I say, as technology unfolds, I'm not as comforted anymore by technology as far as my safety.
Right. I think we all feel that.
Yeah. So, I mean, and think about our homes.
Mm-hmm.
Our homes are constantly being run more off of technology. You can connect to things, whether it's your thermostat, your cameras, yeah. our bank accounts.
Your doorbell. Right.
Yeah. So there's so many potential breaches that on some level, and by the way, I'm thinking about this as an American.
Mm-hmm.
So in fairness to the situation, we think about it globally. Not everybody has access to what we have here.
No, no doubt.
Meaning like credit system.
Right. Financial system, period. Right.
I feel safest using a credit card. I mm-hmm. get a statement.
Uh-huh.
If I've had fraud committed,
right.
oftentimes the credit card company is going to stand in my shoes on my behalf.
Right.
So I feel a little bit like Big Brother is on my side. And if I'm paying a little bit more for the use of a card
mm-hmm.
or transaction fee,
mm-hmm.
you know what? I'd rather give a little vig to that Big Brother behind me
mm-hmm.
than roll the dice and lose it all.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes through my head when we deal with this. And even like wire transfers. Think about all the wire transfer fraud that we all hear about.
Yeah.
It happens all the time. And then the newest one I heard is you can get on a video call with somebody to engage in a financial transaction that there's technology that will replicate what a person looks like and sounds like.
I was told this by a very high-profile person who I will keep her name anonymous. She got contacted by a charity to come and speak to a group of people for this specific charity. They actually had a Zoom call. They had aped this woman's voice and her image. Artificial intelligence, obviously, we're talking about. And they got on a Zoom call with these people and were able to block out this person's face somehow to still make it seem like it was her. And make a long story short, they wrote a big fat deposit check to this bogus person. They created a bogus email address, all these different handles, social media. It was like a massive, I mean, this is for you, an enforcement attorney. This is like stuff that you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning excited about chasing this guy. Isn't this amazing?
Yeah, no. So the more I hear about the advancements of technology that I enjoy as a consumer of it,
uh-huh.
the other end of it is the financial aspects to it and the potential misuse of the technology.
Right.
And so those are all the things. There's so many unanswered questions
mm-hmm.
that there are times I'm okay with sometimes dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And old technology because there's to some degree of safety to it.
No doubt about it. The good old pen and paper can work wonders sometimes.
I mean, now, I mean, I just finished building a home. I have to literally connect every appliance to the web.
Oh, I know.
Otherwise, you don't get updates on your hardware.
Right. It's crazy. And it's just going to get worse, Ron. There's good and bad to that, like everything, like we said earlier. Ron Geffner, I can go on hours with you. I hope we can continue this conversation because I have many other things I wanted to ask you, and time has just flown on by. I really appreciate your background and your wisdom and your knowledge in this space, and I cannot thank you enough for this chat.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I want to thank you for the amazing questions and the subject matter, and thanks for scaring me so I won't fall asleep tonight.
Okay, good.
And I hope to be back.
I look forward to it, Ron, and we'll be spreading the word about this podcast. Ron Geffner, former SEC enforcement lawyer with a resume a mile long. You see him all over the tube. He's appeared on every major cable news network and more. And regularly quoted in so many different publications. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today, Ron.
Thank you so much for your time today.
And we'll look forward to the next time.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Jimmy Fitz is Crypto Fitz. Saturdays, 7 to 10 a.m. Classic rock and crypto on Q 102.3.